We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frain, is at the controls. It was not that long ago that major newspapers and the big television networks dominated the gathering and dissemination of news. But today, newspapers are struggling with a loss of advertising revenue. Many of them have cut staff and cut pages. Network news faces some similar challenges, and both of them face competition from emerging forms of digital journalism. As the shape of journalism changes, some people also wonder about its future and ask questions like, well, what kind of news do people really want, and what kind of news do they need? And maybe ultimately the question is, what kind of news is commercially viable? This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll try to talk a little bit about this changing landscape of American journalism. And our guest for the program is Michael Shudson. He is professor of journalism at Columbia University at the journalism school there. He is, by his academic training, a sociologist and has written widely on the sociology of the American news media, on advertising and popular culture, among other things. His work has appeared in Columbia Journalism Review, Wilson Quarterly, The American Prospect, and as well has published op-eds that have been published in the New York Times, Washington Post, the LA Times. He is the co-author, along with Leonard Downey, who's a former executive editor of the Washington Post, a co-author of a report issued maybe about a month or so ago by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. And the title of the report is The Reconstruction of American Journalism. And it looks at all of the things that I just mentioned very briefly in the introduction. If you'd like to read it, you can go to the website of the Journalism School there at Columbia University. There is also a bit shorter version that has been published in the Columbia Journalism Review, also with some interesting reaction from other people in the field and just from various people who read all of this commentary. And it's quite interesting. There's a lot for people who are in the media business, certainly, to chew over, and for consumers of media as well. So that's something that you can certainly look at if you have internet access. And here in this part of the show, as we talk about journalism and some of the challenges faced by big news operations today, questions from listeners are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So questions are welcome. We just ask people to be brief as you can so we can get in as many callers as possible. But calls are certainly welcome. Again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, Professor Shudson, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. You know, here at WILL, like people in a lot of other news organizations, are right now trying to wrestle with all of the things that you deal with in the report about the changing media technology and how we try to take advantage of that, about how we stay alive. And it's as true if you are a nonprofit as we are, as it is for those who are for-profits. A lot of really good material here for people in our business to think about. And in fact, even just trying to digest the short version, it just makes my head spin. So for somebody like me that's in this business, we come at it in one way. I guess I'm thinking, though, of trying to turn that around a little bit and to ask you to think about or talk about what these questions really mean to people who are not journalists, who are not in the news business, the people who are the consumers of news. I mean, do these changes and how news organizations meet them really matter to people who are not in this business?
I think they matter very much. I mean, when you ask people where they get their news, people are inclined to say, from television or from the internet or a generic response like that. But where does television get the news, and where does the internet get the news? Overwhelmingly, the answer is from the people who put together newspapers. That's not everything, but it's 80 or 90% of everything. So if we lose the newspapers, we lose a lot along with that. We lose most of the local, national, and global news that we're used to relying on. What difference does that make? We have some studies that indicate when you lose the local newspaper, you get an increase in corruption in local government, just to name one significant factor. There's a lot that is at stake here in making sure that one way or another, whether newspapers as we have known them survive, that the news-gathering function will be supported by our society somehow.
Certainly there have been other times when there have been dramatic changes in technology, communications technology, that have changed people's access to news, where they got news, how it is that people gathered and distributed news. Do you think that somehow, though, the time that we're at now is different? Is this really so different from those major points in the past?
I'm inclined to think it is. You're quite right that it's not like we had just one model of news gathering and news dissemination over the past several hundred years, since Gutenberg. There have been significant technological revolutions and economic revolutions in how news is put together and how it reaches us. But this is the first time that the new technology has not only been added to the existing news organizations, but is seriously threatening to replace them. The internet, with the kind of underlying ethos and motto that information wants to be free, has made it very difficult for the major engines of news gathering for the past several centuries, the newspapers, to compete. They've tried various models, but the newspapers remain among the most visited news sites, newspapers and traditional broadcast organizations, among the most visited sites online. But they're not making much money from those sites. Mm-hmm. And newspapers are a business. The New York Times, the chief example here, had up until recently some 1,200 people in their newsroom. They're down 100 to 200 now. And that's a modest decline compared to many of the leading newspapers in the country that have lost a third to a half of their news staff. That's really threatening the continued usefulness of newspapers as really nothing. I mean, television was a threat. Radio before that was a threat, but newspapers survived and flourished in the face of those. Whether that can happen now is a real question.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about readership here. Again, just talking about print sources, because I think that some people have suggested that the problem here is that the average newspaper reader is getting older, and young people just aren't in the newspaper habit. And maybe it's because they're used to getting their news from other places, and there's that concern that if younger people don't sort of get in this habit of reading newspapers, then the audience for papers is really going to die out. And some people would say that that trend is already happening. Other people have said, well, actually, if you look at readership and circulation, you know, it's really not that bad. Maybe not what it was, but it's not that bad. What really is the story with newspaper readership?
Well, if we're talking about readership of the print version of newspapers, mm-hmm. it is declining. It has been declining for half a century. Slowly, circulation has declined year by year, and it is continuing that trend. Young people have always, or as far back as we have data, been less attached to newspapers than older people, but pick up the habit once they're in their 20s and 30s. But they seem to be picking up the habit at a much slower pace than they were in the past. So there really is a decline that is going to cost newspapers circulation in the print version. But the online readership of newspapers is growing by leaps and bounds. And, you know, we don't know as much as we'd like to about how much time people spend online at CNN.com or NYTimes.com compared to if they would pick that up by turning on the television or by picking up a print paper. But it does so that on the one hand, the paying audience is continuing to decline, particularly among the young, but the actual reading audience is growing.
And that, I guess, then that goes back to the we come to the importance of the internet and the fact that on the one hand we could say people are reading. Say they're reading the New York Times on the internet, but that right from the beginning, the problem was that companies like the New York Times and other big news outlets didn't know how big that was going to become, or they didn't really have a good way to try to get people to pay them some money for the privilege of reading it online. And then they got people used to the idea that it didn't cost anything. And then when you get to the point where they suddenly decide, hey, wait a minute, we're giving this stuff away. We can't afford to do that. No one really had a very good idea how to charge. People were used to getting it for free. And so it's suddenly now we have this huge problem where all these people reading it online and they have decided that they shouldn't have to pay for the privilege, and no one's quite been able to figure out what to do about that.
That's right. It's as if you could depend on for gathering news from dropping into the local Starbucks and picking up a paper from some other table where someone had left it. That's the kind of habit we've gotten into. Online, there's a lot of lateral circulation of news as people email to their friends a story they had seen because they went to a news site online, that's actually a wonderful habit. I mean, I make use of it every day, and lots of people do, and it's a kind of a socializing and democratizing of the whole news experience, which has a lot to recommend it for just about everyone except the news organizations that can't make any money that way. We had for a long time a kind of happy accident that newspapers were able to gather news around the world because they put together an audience that was of interest to Macy's or Best Buy. I mean, Best Buy was out there willing to subsidize the Baghdad Bureau because the newspaper was the place where they could gather an audience that would be interested in their ad. That happy accident of you know, the last 100 years and to some extent the last 50 years, really, as newspapers became kind of local monopolies. We're at the end of that phase, and we are looking, and the newspapers are looking fairly desperately to find something that will successfully replace that.
Yeah, that's I think that's another important point, and another way that the internet plays into what it is we're talking about. I think people have to understand that people paid for a copy of the paper never covered the operating costs of the paper.
No, not at all.
It was advertising that made this an economically viable institution, and that is something that has been that the internet has cut, particularly classifieds, but I'm sure other kinds of ads as well. The internet has just cut that right out from under newspapers, and suddenly what was a very good and very dependable source of revenue to keep the paper going is just gone.
That's right. I mean, in the first instance, this is really an advertising crisis, not mm-hmm. a news crisis.
Mm-hmm. Let me just introduce once again our guest for anybody who maybe has recently tuned in. We're talking with Michael Shudson. He's professor of journalism at Columbia University and has written a lot about American news media, things like advertising, popular culture. He is the co-author of a recent report that was commissioned by and released by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism titled The Reconstruction of American Journalism. He co-authored this with Leonard Downey Jr., who is a former executive editor of The Washington Post. You can go to the website of the Columbia University Journalism School, and you can read it that way. There's also a kind of a shorter version that was published in the Columbia Journalism Review. That's something that you can read online. So if you're interested in taking a look at this, you certainly can. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, as you mentioned, I think that a lot of people say that what really we're talking about here is an economic kind of crisis. It's not so much a content crisis. At the same time, I think that there are a lot of people who are asking questions about what it is that newspapers and also broadcast outlets and radio and television, you know, what it is that we are doing in terms of content and whether or not we should be doing something different. And I think that it really comes down to this question, and maybe it's always been a question, you know, what kind of news do we think people need and what kind of news do they think they need or they want? And the fact that maybe there's always been a kind of a gulf between those two things.
Yes, there has long been such a gulf. I mean, the news as we think about it today is of relatively recent vintage. I mean, the classic American newspaper of the 19th century was a rabidly partisan newspaper. The idea that news should be gathered by professionals who have some degree of detachment and keep their own opinions to the side while they ask questions of public officials and corporate executives and others who are making news. That's really about 100 years old at most. And it wasn't until the 1960s that you got added to that the strong view that the best newspaper should not be just reproducing what, mimicking or mirroring what the public official says, but taking it with a grain of salt and looking closely and critically at it and giving you something of the background to it. And as you moved into that more professional and critical model of journalism, you also moved into a much more expensive journalism, and that's what's at stake here. You know, what did the general population want? That's always been a little bit hard to know what sort of evolved in particularly the newspaper, the Metropolitan Daily Newspaper, is you assemble a variety of things. You have the business page and the stock market report for the relatively wealthy. You have the sports page for people of a strong interest and often a strong expertise in following sports. You have the crossword puzzle. You have the astrology tables, and you have the general news. As if within the newspaper itself, there are a set of kind of cross subsidies going on. The news that seems most important for a democratic society concerns those aspects that are about our common fate as a polity and a society. What are our neighbors doing? How can we learn more about them? What is our government doing? And how does that relate to our own preferences? What's happening with elections, and what do we know about the candidates? Because there's the place where, classically, we have a chance to participate in society. That's the key content of news that matters most for maintaining a democratic society. But it has long been subsidized by a variety of things you'd call more generally just entertainment. So it's not like we don't know what will sell a newspaper or what will sell a news magazine. Today it's Sarah Palin on the cover. Now, why? Because we're interested in her political ideas, or because she's sort of an entertaining public figure? I mean, in her case, it's a kind of combination. But I don't see anything wrong in newspapers providing entertainment. But I do see something wrong in newspapers giving up on the Baghdad Bureau.
I guess one of the big concerns here is that the kind of reporting that you're talking about, thorough reporting on government and its activities, thorough reporting on particular issues, political, social issues, national and international, the investigative reporting, the kinds of things that you're talking about here. Doing this kind of work, it takes time and it takes resources, it takes people, and it helps if you have people who are actually experienced and have done that sort of thing. It is the kind of thing that you really need a significant organization to do, although I suppose some people would argue that it is possible to do this with maybe fewer resources on a local level, if what you're saying, is we're going to do that, but we're going to do that for our community. In any case, I think that there are important questions about whether or not that kind of journalism, if we lose our big news organizations that have significant resources, whether that kind of journalism is going to go away and whether anybody is going to be able to do it anymore.
That's the real question. And here there's some good news, I think, along with the bad news. And the good news is that the Internet allows quite small news organizations, but real news organizations that hire and pay experienced journalists, it allows them to produce, to do real news gathering with much more limited resources than a traditional newspaper required. The traditional newspaper not only has to pay journalists, it has to pay the people who drive the trucks to deliver the newspapers to distribution locations. It then has to pay the paper carriers. It has to pay for paper and ink that turn out to be very expensive. It has to maintain the big printing presses that are very expensive, and so on. All of that is eliminated with a newspaper that is essentially just a website. And that gives the opening to what are now dozens of scores of startup news organizations all over the country. Some of them are purely amateur affairs and are what's called citizen journalism. But the ones I'm talking about are professional organizations. They may make use of citizens and neighbors to bring them news, but that's something that in different forms newspapers have been doing for since Benjamin Franklin. But you can run an actual news-gathering, critical reporting operation with 2, 5, 10, 15 journalists. That's, you know, no large metropolitan newspaper operated that way. They have hundreds of journalists. But some of these startups are giving them a run for their money in their own cities in gathering news. That's the interesting and quite fresh and exciting development.
And does that mean, do you think, that in over the near term here we're going to see more and more journalism moving online, and there's less and less of it that's going to appear in a printed form unless people decide they want to do that for themselves?
You are going to see, we are seeing more and more news organizations developing online. It would seem very odd to be starting a print newspaper today. Those that exist, many of them are going to continue, and particularly in smaller communities, communities, say, where Craigslist does not yet have a presence. They can still maintain enough advertising, including classified advertising, to make a decent profit. So that's happening. We have some 1,400 newspapers in the country. We've lost in the past few years a few dozen, but there's still these hundreds of others that are surviving. And I expect will survive for a long time to come, but the new direction, the new opportunities are for online journalism. That's where we're going to see growth and innovation and change.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Michael Schudson. He is professor of journalism at Columbia University, has written a lot about American news media, advertising, popular culture. He's the co-author, along with Leonard Downey, Jr., former executive editor of The Washington Post, of a recent report, The Reconstruction of American Journalism. It was released by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. You can read it on their website. There's also a kind of a condensed version that was published by the Columbia Journalism Review. There's interesting reading there, and not just for people who are in the news business, but for anyone who is a consumer of news and concerned about the role that the media play in our communities. Questions are welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. We do have someone to bring into the conversation in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. I don't know, Professor and David, does this critique extend to broadcast journalism as well? I don't want to get off into an area that is not, quote, relevant, but is broadcast journalism come within the same critique?
Oh, yeah, yes, indeed.
Okay,
yes, indeed.
I know,
yes.
David has has sort of a new admonishment now that we should stay on the topic. But anyway, I read the newspaper. In fact, I learned how to read as a child, reading my daily newspaper down in the South. My concern is, and I still read the New York Times and the USA Today every morning, but the quality of broadcast journalism, it seems to be so lacking in this country. I think one time a New York Times columnist, Frank Rich, referred to it as journalism light because there doesn't seem to be a significant investigative component. It's too opinionated and not based on what I call fact-based journalism. It's skewed, it's superficial or shallow. In fact, when I travel, recently I was in Toronto and was enthralled with the Canadian Broadcasting Company, and I listened to WILL religiously from 8 o'clock to 5 in the morning, where I listened to the BBC. And in terms of investigative, in terms of dealing with issues in a substantive way as opposed to saturated coverage of the Balloon Boy or Sarah Palin or disregard for fact-checking, I find that the broadcast media, falls short of Canada, the brief experience I've had with it, and the British Broadcasting Company, the experience my local NPR station allows me. And I want to say this, to be fair, David, but for WILL's local coverage, I'm not impressed with what comes out of NPR as well. So can you comment on that, Professor?
I'd be happy to. We focus primarily on the newspapers in our report because we're most concerned that I think in a variety of ways that national news coverage is going to survive. There's a strong enough general interest in it and a strong enough financial interest in it that in fact some of the online startups are particularly skillful and useful in covering Washington, D.C. But at the local level, the metropolitan level across the country, we're really worried that what we call in the report accountability journalism, that kind of critical news coverage focused on government that will keep it responsible responsive to the voters, that's what we may lose. When we look at what exists there now, it is overwhelmingly the newspapers that provide it. What commercial television provides locally, with some distinguished exceptions, but they are the exceptions, is just drawn from the local newspaper in very small bits, and most of the rest is car crashes and crime. That's not the sort of news that's going to enrich a local community or keep local government on its toes. So in terms of public broadcasting, I think I value national public radio perhaps more than you do, but we would like to see, and the report recommends, that more support, financial support, goes to national public radio and its affiliates, particularly to allow them to hire people at the affiliates for covering local news. I don't know the case of WILL, but most public radio affiliates just don't do local news. They take the NPR feed for national and global news, but don't do their own additional local news, and we'd like to see that changed.
One more question. Do you think the problem that I've outlined with regard to broadcast journalism in general is a function of, one, I know resources, and I think this journalism light allows for people to be lazy and still think they're practicing good journalism. But I also sense that there is an obsession with ratings that does color what types of materials are covered in broadcast journalism, whether it's the mainstream media or broadcast media, and especially cable news. Would you comment on that?
Yes. You're right that on television and radio, competition for audience is fierce and fairly precisely measurable, too. So even small changes you can see making a difference. So that has not helped. you're right. That has not helped. But I think the larger factor is the one, when you talk about Canada or Britain or basically most of Western Europe, they have very strong and very well-funded public broadcasting. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting that is the government, is the conduit for government monies to our public broadcasting system, it has essentially a trivial budget compared to the BBC gets through the television license fee, which is how the BBC is supported, £3.5 billion, what is that, something like $6 billion a year. I mean, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting would be very happy to have a 10% of that, and they don't. I mean, we're not even in the same ballpark in terms of public financial support for broadcasting.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Other questions or comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. This brings us to the question of financing. And certainly it's something that you deal with in your report. And I think that some people perhaps raise this question, is it possible for news organizations to do the kind of reporting that we would like them to do, particularly this kind of reporting that you referred to as accountability journalism? Is it possible to do that if you are a for-profit venture? And I think that some people would suggest that, you know, the problem with broadcast news and cable news and maybe a lot of local television news and so forth, the problem is that they have to make a profit, and that it would be argued that doing more serious kind of journalism, you can't make a profit that way. And so maybe the model that we should be looking at is some kind for news organizations, some kind of nonprofit setup.
Right. Well, in the list of recommendations in our report, we're rather hopeful about more nonprofit models emerging. Most of the online startups are nonprofit. They're organized as 501c3, so they're tax exempt because they are nonprofit. So they're supported by individual philanthropists or by a number of foundations. The Knight Foundation has been particularly active in this. We would like to see more of that, and you know, our system, unlike the democracies of Western Europe, has been more than 90% commercial. We'd like to see a bit better mix, a more substantially financed public system, we're trying to encourage foundations, philanthropists, and others to see news as a kind of public utility and public service that deserves their support and is one of the basic institutions that makes keeping powerful institutions accountable to the general public is an absolute requirement for that. So it's a kind of mixed model we see. Commercial organizations will continue. Nonprofits and public supported will be added to the mix. Yes, you're right that commercial organizations have biases necessarily that keep them from being as critical as one would like. I would add, though, that wherever you get your money from, whether it's the government, a philanthropist, or the marketplace, there will be a set of biases. That's why we'd like to see a kind of mixed financial support for the news media.
Something that I think is very interesting that you look at is that there are various places where in communities, people who previously might have seen themselves in competition have said, well, why don't we come together? Why don't we work together? I mean, they're looking for collaborations. They're looking for partnerships and putting their energy together towards this common goal of saying, we really want to do good news coverage, good accountability journalism, concentrate on really important news in our community. And I think also part of the thing is they're saying there are, you know, we can only do so much. We can't cover the entire world. And there are certain kinds of news maybe we'll say we're just not going to do that. But what we're going to do is we're really going to concentrate on important things that really bear on life in this community. And then we're going to come together and say, you know, being first with a story is not so important as really doing a good job with the story. And that's something that I think is really interesting.
I think it's very interesting, too. And it's a relatively new idea for most news organizations that up until quite recently, have been very jealous in guarding their own scoop or their own exclusive story. And while some of that remains, there's more and more cooperation. The leading metropolitan papers in Ohio, for instance, have developed a scheme for sharing newspapers so that the Cleveland paper will share its Cleveland stories with the Dayton paper, and the Dayton paper will share its Dayton stories with Cleveland. And the bad news here is it allows them to hire fewer reporters. The good news is that it allows them to stay in business by sharing resources, being able to sort of specialize in different areas. Some of the startups, like the one in the city I just moved from, San Diego, the Voice of San Diego.org, is an organization of about 15 people. That means about a dozen professional journalists, and they decided that they weren't going to cover the waterfront. They were going to cover the key political and economic issues that were of most concern and most controversial for the city. Now, they're not going to do the movie reviews. They're not going to cover the Padres or the Chargers. So a lot of people say, well, why should I bother to go online? It doesn't have the wide variety of news and entertainment that I'm used to in a news organization. Well, that's true. It doesn't. And it may never get the kind of circulation directly that the San Diego Union-Tribune has had for a long time. But those reporters at Voice of San Diego are visible on commercial television. They're visible on public radio. They have made themselves available to share their stories and their reporting with the general public through more available general purpose media. And that seems to be working. And that's the sort of thing that's going on, again, in more and more places around the country.
Yeah. We have maybe about 10 minutes left, a little bit less, in this part of Focus 580. And our guest for this hour is Michael Schudson. He is professor of journalism at Columbia University and is the co-author of a recently released report, something commissioned and released by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, the report titled The Reconstruction of American Journalism. And you can go to their website and read it if you like. Also go and read a slightly condensed version on the website of the Columbia Journalism Review. And questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that now the technologies that we have makes possible is more of a relationship and maybe also more of a real-time relationship between readers and audience and papers and online news sources and creators and broadcasters. There is this opportunity for much more feedback from readers, much more sort of participation. I think that it's not so much on their end, not so much a passive act anymore of them just sitting there reading the paper or them turning on the radio or turning on the television and just sitting there. And this is something I think also that news organizations are still trying to figure out how they do that and what they do with that. But I wonder whether you think that kind of change in the relationship between the news generator and the news consumer is – how important is that?
Yeah, I think it's tremendously important. We've had elements of that in the past. We've had letters to the editor from the 1700s on, and readers – viewers have communicated with their news media outlets by telephone, by sending in a tip. But the difference between that and the ability online or by email to get back instantly to the reporter, the editor, about a story or a photo that you just saw makes a world of difference. It makes a world of difference, mostly positive, in my view, a bit negative, because it has caused journalists to be more and more sensitive to what's the most popular story, what's the most emailed story, and that has a tendency to push reporters to orient themselves to to most popular. And as you remember from elementary school or high school, most popular doesn't mean best. That's true in journalism, too. That said, to actually know what your audience is thinking, to have your audience reply, sometimes because they're more expert than you, is an enormous advantage. It is not so many years ago now, 3, 4, when I told my students, no, you can't use Wikipedia as a source in a research paper. Now I tell them, why don't you take a look at Wikipedia, at least to get yourself started? It is an incredible resource. So it is an incredible resource. People, there's a saying that in the computer business world that as you assemble people for a meeting from your organization, that the only thing you can be sure of is the person who knows most about the subject you're about to discuss isn't in the room. Why? I mean, you hired these great people, but because there's always an expert out there who you didn't know about. And it's the ability to communicate online voluntarily, responding, that identifies some of those experts. Experts maybe from their own experience rather than from a college degree, but experts on the topic who have something to say.
We have some callers here. We'll try to get them both, and time remains. First in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hi. I guess a lot of it has to do with the Internet, but I think what made a lot of the major newspapers so vulnerable is that they had sort of ceased to do any real investigative reporting some time ago. I know a few years ago I hadn't picked up a St. Louis Post-Dispatch in a long time, and all I'd read is the Chicago papers, the Tribune, the Sun-Times. And I was kind of shocked reading the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I was like, oh, look at this. You know, there was all this investigative stuff going after, you know, rich owners of nursing homes and all kinds of stuff. And I just realized, no, my papers in Chicago had gotten so cowardly to do any of this stuff that it just didn't exist in my everyday newspaper life until I, you know, picked up this paper. In my own mind, I kind of trace this back to the early 70s when there was a really big push by the right wing. They didn't like that newspapers were printing bad things. I don't know if people remember, but they made this big push that there's lots of good things happening. Newspapers need to print positive stories, not just the bad things. Now, what they were really talking about is they didn't like seeing pictures of police hosing down civil rights demonstrators. They didn't like pictures from Vietnam of children getting napalmed. That's what they didn't like, but they didn't quite put it that way. And I think the newspapers reacted, and they just sort of got very, very cowardly and just put in lots of, like, happy stuff. And so when the Internet came along, they were really vulnerable. I mean, all of a sudden, you know, you can, it may not be the truth, everything you read on the Internet, but you can get a lot of stuff. And I would guess that most big city newspapers are pretty much like Chicago's. I won't miss them at all if they're gone. They don't print anything I'm not very interested in.
Well, it gets Professor Shudson, what do you think?
Right. I read the history a little different than you do, in that I don't think there was that the period in which there was a lot of investigative reporting was a pretty brief window in American newspaper history. It, in some ways, it begins in the 60s with the occasional muckraking before, but as a part in which a part of the newspaper that the new editors and publisher are willing to invest in as separate teams of investigative reporters, that really begins in the 1960s. And, you know, it had a a flowering and then a tapering off. There, I think I agree with you. And the tapering off has gotten worse as the financial crunch has gotten more severe over the last 10 years. So I think we've been short on investigative reporting, and we're getting shorter on it.
We're coming down to the point here where we have to finish. I find myself thinking that maybe I'm a dinosaur, but I guess I find myself thinking that something that we have lost with the news cycle becoming as fast as it is, and it becoming as easy to publish something on the web, to write something and put it out there, and then for somebody to fire off a response and for you to fire back a response to the response, I do find myself wondering, what's happened to time for contemplation? Do we really have time to think about things anymore before we end up firing off a response? I guess I just wonder about the speed at which things go,
right,
and whether or not that's completely a good thing.
It is not completely a good thing. I heard just a few days ago in the New York Times journalist David Carr saying he was giving a talk where he said, I am really worried that my job is now making me stupid. And what he meant was that he's so busy blogging and tweeting and churning stuff out on a more rapidly and more frequently during the day, that he doesn't have as much time as he once did to take stuff in. So I think your concern is a real one, and I'm, you know, I think there's at some point where journalists are going to have to say, but they're not in a position to yet. You know, stop the world. I want to get off. Stop the world. I want to have a chance to sit back and think about this problem hard, because it requires some research. It requires some reflection.
Our guest for this hour, Focus 580, Michael Schudson. He is professor of journalism at Columbia University, and he is the co-author, along with Leonard Downey, former executive editor at The Washington Post, of a recent report, The Reconstruction of American Journalism. It was released about a month ago by Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. You can read the full version there. You can read a shorter, condensed version at the website of the Columbia Journalism Review. I'm sure we'll be talking about these things again in the future. For now, though, we'd say, Professor Schudson, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.